The mind, by nature, is radiant and pure, the Buddha said. It is shining. It is because of visiting forces known as defilements that we suffer. It is because of visiting forces known as defilements that we suffer. If you stop for a minute and think about the ways that you suffer in your life, or the ways that beings suffer in the world, it's pretty overwhelming. But the Buddha said that it's because of these forces that visit the mind that cause all this suffering. Well, if we could believe that with absolute faith, wouldn't it be to our benefit to really understand what the defilements are? What the scope of the danger is with the defilements? How to work with them in order to minimize the danger of them? And then how to understand them so that we're not victimized by these visiting forces that come to the mind. For many years, I think, in Western Dharma circles, we talk about kind of safe defilements. We talk about the hindrances, and we talk about the obstacles to practice, and we talk about things that, you know, are really the problem, you know. And not too many teachers actually use the word defilements, because it's kind of like an old biblical word or something, like, your mind's defiled. But actually, I like the word defilements, because it really points to how dangerous, how pernicious, how much suffering they cause in our minds. So what are the defilements? Let's be clear on what we're talking about. Well, they're all forms of greed, hatred, or delusion. The grossest forms of aversion, you know, is rage and hatred and anger that collectively manifests as war and discrimination and oppression. The grossest forms of desire are insatiable aggression to get what you want. Again, played out on a national or international scale, it's just phenomenal. But we also have gross forms of aversion and desire. There are subtle forms of aversion. The subtlest forms of aversion are just being kind of peeved, kind of being irritated, being cynical, or being critical. These are also forms of aversion. We might not think that cynicism is a defilement, but think about how much suffering you have when you're cynical about politicians. You know, and it's just a way of insulating you from the unpleasantness of what's going on. So we get cynical. But it's actually a way of avoiding dealing with the way things really are. Delusion is an interesting defilement, because what is delusion anyway? Well, that's the problem with delusion. We don't even know what it is, hardly. But the subtlest forms is just not knowing what's going on. And I don't mean that you don't know what time of day it is. I mean, that's, if you don't look at the watch, you won't know. But we often live our life without knowing what's going on in our heart, without knowing what our motivation is for doing what we do. We don't know. We're just acting at the mercy of forces that we don't understand. That's delusion. Or we understand them wrongly. We see something, we think we understand it, and we understand it wrongly. We think people or opportunities or experiences can offer us something that they're incapable of offering. That's delusion. We mistake what we see. We don't know, or we know wrongly. So any manifestation, from the grossest to the subtlest, of aversion, attachment, delusion, causes suffering. These are the defilements. But when you look at your life, and you look at your mind, and you look at how you live in relationship to others, we are so, personally, each one of us is so accustomed to the defilements, they're so habitual, they're so strong, they're so, well, I won't say ever-present, but they're pretty present, that we take them for granted. We accept them as, oh, this is the way it is. And in fact, they sometimes are so frequently visiting the mind that we consider them who we really are. It's not only that I experience impatience frequently, but I become an impatient person. Or not just that, you know, you might be irritated or angry often, you become an angry person. Well, this wrong understanding of these forces to the mind causes a tremendous amount of suffering, not only to ourselves, but we look at other people and we categorize them in the same way. They're a greedy person. They're an angry person. They're a hateful person. And because we stereotype them with some behavioral trait, which we see appearing in the mind and in their behavior frequently, we isolate them. We cause ourselves and them more suffering. Well, because they appear so frequently, because we're so habituated to just living with the suffering that they bring, we consider that they are an integral part of me, who I am. Well, this has consequences. It prevents us from living our life fully. We're not open to the full range of what life offers. It's impossible to practice effectively when you're not open to all that life offers. And if we're not open to what life offers, how will we ever find peace of mind? The whole path of practice is learning to identify, to work with, and to understand the defilements. That is the whole path of practice. When there are no more defilements to discover, to work with, to get a handle on, or to understand, you're done. You're finished. Happily ever after, no more suffering. Well, when I look at my mind, I see there's room for improvement. This is the defilements. Now, what is the scope of the problem or the danger with these defilements? Well, when these unwholesome states of mind arise, any of the defilements, they are the cause for the natural result, which is unpleasantness. Unpleasant body, unpleasant mind. Sometimes they occur in the moment. You know, when you get angry, you feel the contraction of the body, the heat of the mind, the tightness, the self-righteousness. It's immediate. It's physical, it's mental, it's suffering. It comes as a natural result of the cause of aversion. It's not your fault that the mind gets tight, that the body gets hot. We could say it's the fault of aversion. But it's really the aversion that is not seen, that's not understood, that's not observed with awareness that causes it. When the defilements arise, if they're not observed, if they're not recognized, if they're not acknowledged, they will only grow in strength. To deny them, to minimize them, to avoid them, to kind of pretend that they're not there, only feeds them. Now, the danger of the defilements is that they obscure our view of what's going on. We know, of course, if there's delusion in the mind, you're not going to see things clearly. But when desire is in the mind, it causes the mind to see only the pleasant aspect of what you're looking at. Now, we know everything has two sides. You know, there's something pleasant about it, and then there's the flip side, the dark side, which is a little unpleasant. But when desire's in the mind, you don't see that unpleasantness. Impossible. That's what desire in the mind does. It blinds us to seeing the unpleasant capability of this particular experience. But when aversion is in the mind, we can only see the unpleasant aspect of something or someone. We can't see the pleasantness. You know, when you're really angry at someone, it is impossible to think of their goodness, to remember their goodness. All we see is what we can be critical of them about. You know, the way they hold their hands, their face, the way they walk, the way they look, what they wear, everything they do, what they say, everything about them. It's not them. They have their good side. They have their unpleasant side. They have their pleasant side. It's the mind that's colored or influenced or visited by aversion that causes us to see only in that way. Aversion is always accompanied by delusion. Desire is always accompanied by delusion. There's a spectrum of the gradient, I call it the gradient of delusion, the gradient of defilement, if you will. The worst case scenario is when you're totally lost in your defilement, don't even know it's a defilement, and feel good about it. And you know what? We're quite happy as pigs in slop, you know, until we kind of begin to wake up and see, you know, this is not such a healthy state of mind to be kind of wallowing in. But, you know, when you get angry and you get self-righteously indignant, confident that you should be angry at someone for what they're doing, that's being totally lost and wallowing. But we who've heard the Dharma know that anger is kind of a no-no. It's a baddie. It's a defilement. And so we aren't quite so lost in it. We may be angry. We may be caught in our desire. We're caught in our jealousy. We're caught in our fear. We know it's not such a wholesome state of mind, but can't do anything about it. It's like we're just overwhelmed by it, with it, and try as we might, we can't escape. Well, this, as you know, is a common experience, especially on retreat. You know, you get just minding your own business, paying attention to the way things are, and some defilement visits the mind, uninvited, I might add, and we're just tormented by it. We're obsessed by it. We can't stop planning. We can't stop fearing. We can't stop obsessing about, well, what's your story today? You know? And even though we would like to, we'd like to be able to say, okay, turn it off for a while. We can't. Until we get some momentum to the mindfulness. When there's some momentum to the mindfulness, we can begin to recognize it and either work with it or work with replacing it. You know, when you get really entangled in some form of aversion, hey, practice metta. You get really blaming somebody for something, practice forgiveness. You know, you get really despondent, kind of sad, or kind of bummed out, or kind of in a negative state of mind, arouse joy. If your mindfulness is strong in practicing metta or practicing forgiveness or arousing joy, you can temporarily overcome that defilement. Well, this is an immediate benefit and relief through practicing mindful awareness. But it doesn't last. You know, that habit of jealousy or anger, depression, fear, whatever, has some deep roots. You know, we've been practicing this defilement for 20, 30, 40, 50 or more years. So it's got a head of steam, and just because we happen to notice it and look at it, doesn't mean it's going to stop, temporarily maybe. But it'll be back. And it'll keep coming back until we understand how we get hooked over and over and over again. So we have to get hooked over and over and over again and see how that happens. This is the practice of Vipassana, to really begin to understand how is it this kind of thought runs through the mind, and we, 99 times out of 100, get hooked. How does that happen? Well, there's some feeling, and there's some sense of yourself, and there's some, you know, self-righteousness, and there's a story, and it's an old pattern, and well, we have to see that. But it's through seeing how we get hooked over and over again that we begin to disentangle from these defilements. We might be able to disentangle when the mindfulness is strong and the insight is really clear and sharp. Sometimes we can look at that defilement, we can see its whole structure, and pff, gone. And we think, done with that. Okay, what's next? But it'll be back because the mind isn't always that clear. The mindfulness isn't always that strong. We don't always have the same faith. These are shifting impersonal factors of mind. And so it's in every situation that these defilements arise, we need to see once again and work with it once again. So many times, I've had the experience, and many yogis have come to me with the experience and said, you know, last retreat I really worked on my anger. You know, I don't expect it this retreat. You know, I've seen it. I've seen my jealousy. I've seen my fear. I've seen it. I'm done with it. Maybe. Maybe not. Because there are multiple layers of defilements in the mind. And understanding comes in the moment. You know, what you understood yesterday isn't so accessible today. You may remember it in the head, but it's not in the heart all the time. And that's where the present moment always arises, is in the heart. And so it's the willingness to engage the heart in every moment of defilement that is going to lead to this comprehensive understanding that, well, in the end, frees us from the defilement. So how do we work with these defilements? Well, the first ingredient or the first key is to get informed what are the defilements. You know, we say greed, hatred, and delusion. Well, we've been working on having this book from the Burmese tradition that Mahasi Sayadaw wrote about practicing Vipassana, translated into English to be made available, published here in the West. And in it, he acknowledges that there are more than 1,000 defilements listed in the text. That's a lot. You know, I mean, I think we'd be hard pressed to come up with more than 20, but 1,000. So, just getting some information about what are these defilements? What do they look like? What do they taste like? How do they feel like? How do we recognize them in ourselves and others? That information is valuable. Because sometimes we don't want to hear. You know, we don't want to hear that our behavior is really defiled behavior, or the behavior that we're displaying, or the thought that's in our mind is really defiled, or is causing us or others suffering. You know, we try to feel good about ourselves, you know, and we'll do what it takes to kind of live in illusion, that illusion. But Dharma practice is all about being disillusioned, coming out from under illusion to be disillusioned. And so to see our habits of mind, to see the habits of mind is really essential. So learning to recognize these defilements, how they manifest in our mind, in our bodies, in others' behavior. This takes perception. This takes cultivating and strengthening clarity of perception. Again, it's the first step in overcoming this familiar indulgence in our personality that's required. And then the second step in working with the defilements is not only beginning to recognize them, but to acknowledge them. We recognize them, but we can recognize something and still be a little distant from it. When I say to recognize and acknowledge, I mean recognize and acknowledge. It's right here, right now. I'm, you know, the sense of me is entangled with it. Well, that's a big step. That's a big step to accept this is the way it is right now. I can remember on the first 3-month retreat I did in 83, I guess. There was a period of time for 6 weeks I was just, well, victimized by sloth and torpor. But for half of that time, for 3 or 4 weeks, I didn't recognize it. Now, you'd think that if you're really just kind of bobbing and nodding and just kind of, you know, it's kind of the, aren't I really calm? You know, you'd think you'd recognize it. But only if your perception is willing to acknowledge this is what's going on. And we can be lost in anger, we can be lost in jealousy, we can be lost in fear, not recognize it. So it takes some pretty substantial mindfulness and clear perception to recognize these defilements. So if we can understand what the defilements are, and we can begin to recognize or acknowledge, accept that this is the way it is for me right now, then we can begin to work with them intelligently. If you don't recognize them, if you don't know what they are, you can't work with them. So recognition, acceptance, then we can work with them intelligently. If they are so strong that you're overwhelmed by any of the defilements, we need to recognize that they're overwhelming, that the force or the strength of them is overwhelming. And we need to exercise some pretty strong, proactive tools. You know, replace. This is not the time to kind of go exploring your sleepiness. You'll just fall asleep. It's not the time to go exploring your anger. You'll just get caught in self-righteous indignation. This is not the time to go exploring your desire. You'll just go act. You'll find some way to act it out, strategizing to act it out, because it's so strong. So then we need to really exercise some, well, you know, it's the, is it the Nancy Reagan practice? Just don't do it, or whatever, or something like that. Or it's the Nike. It's a non-Nike practice. Just don't do it. Right? Okay. So it's exercise of some restraint, which sometimes you can replace whatever you're experiencing with a current sense object. You know, sometimes you'll be sitting, your eyes are closed, and you're just in a froth about something. And you open your eyes and you think, hello? I'm just sitting here in this room. Why am I so entangled, so on fire with, you know, some scenario in the mind? And all you have to do is open your eyes and just pay attention to seeing, hearing the present moment sounds, feeling the present moment sensations in the body. It's not avoidance. It's not aversion, getting away from. It's a skillful replacement of an overwhelming defilement with a present moment sense object. Just open your eyes. Check it out. What's actually going on at the sense doors? You can also practice a reflection. A really, you know, I like to teach the chanting of both the refuges, the precepts, and the metta. And, you know, if you're in practice long enough, you'll pick up a few other chants too. Why? Because they're great replacements. Your mind gets all entangled in something. Hey, just start chanting the metta. Just start chanting the refuges and precepts. It'll cut it. If you've got a strong habit of devotion to the refuges and precepts, it can relieve you of a tremendous amount of suffering due to defilement. Or just avoid. Avoid the overwhelming defilement. Don't pay attention to it. Choose something else to pay attention to. Now, that's one way of working with an overwhelming defilement. There's another way that's also helpful, and that is to reframe your wrong understanding about these defilements. Most of us assume that when the defilements arise in our practice, we're doing something wrong. That is not so. It's actually good practice to recognize the defilements. But as long as you're recognizing them, it's good practice. It's when we're indulging in them, it's not good practice. These are habits. They're deeply conditioned habits. They are going to arise when conditions are ripe. So be patient. Understand that this occurrence of this defilement is the natural, lawful result of given conditions. Work on the conditions, the causes. Because if you work with the causes and the conditions, the result of the defilement won't arise. So be patient. That's a good antidote to all of the defilements. But knowing that they're just visitors to the mind, they're not really who you are. They're not an intrinsic, inherent part of you. They're not your personality structure. Knowing that they're just a visitor to the mind, they come, they go. Be persistent. That can encourage you to remind yourself that they're visitors, can encourage you to be really persistent in recognizing them, acknowledging them, accepting this is the way it is, and working with them. Not just kind of being victimized and overwhelmed by them. So be patient with them, being persistent with them, understanding that they are a natural, lawful result of given causes and conditions. Saito Utijaniya says, yogis make the mistake of expecting good experience in practice rather than trying to work with the defilements. Anybody here qualify for that? We all want good experiences. You know, we hope, we come to a retreat hoping to pick up where we left off the last retreat. It's not usually that way. And when, you know, defilements arise, often we're kind of disappointed or frustrated or, you know what, by now we should expect. We should come to retreat knowing I'm going to be looking for and at and dealing with the defilements most of the time. Then when we happen to be defilement-free, we'll really think we're doing something good. It's a default kind of setting in practice. Think that you're going to be dealing with the defilements. And then when you aren't, okay, enjoy that too. After all, mostly the defilements arise as thoughts and feelings. But thoughts are just thoughts, and feelings are just feelings. The Buddha instructed in his second discourse to the ascetics that he taught the Dharma to, he said, you should consider thoughts and feelings, as well as sensations in the body and other things, as not me, not mine, not who I am. He didn't mean deny that they're present. He just said, see that these are not you, not yours, not who you are. And sometimes just that mantra, when you're kind of caught up in some manifestation of defilements, not me, not mine, not who I am. You're not saying it's not happening. You're saying it's happening. You know, you're acknowledging it. You're accepting this is the way it is right now. But it's not me, not mine, not who I am. So with information and intelligence, an intelligent application of our energy, we can begin to understand or gain some insight. And as I mentioned, when any of the defilements are overwhelming, you really can't develop insight. You can barely kind of be aware and not act out. But when there's some level of awareness and the defilements are present, then you can begin to really engage them. And this is an important shift in practice. When you're willing to acknowledge and accept that this is what's happening right now, then you can begin to engage them. And we engage them with this motivation: to understand them. We don't engage them in order to get rid of them. That's aversion. We don't engage them in order to figure them out. That's desire. We engage them in order to understand how they're working in the mind. How'd the mind get entangled in this, get identified with? How does it make the body feel? How does this feeling in the body make the mind think? And so we're looking at how these defilements manifest in the body and the mind, thoughts, feelings, sensations. Because in this willingness to engage them without resistance, without avoidance, without dismissal, just say, what's going on here? Let me feel this. Let me really come to taste fully this defilement. Tremendous understanding comes from being able to engage the defilements. And it is this understanding that will free you from them. Just the experience of it, just being mindful of the hindrance, may bring a temporary relief. But it's when we really understand the defilements that we're able to not get caught again. And that's when we really start to see. You can see it coming. You know, a situation is developing in your body, in your mind, in the interpersonal space you're in. You can see it coming. You can see something happening, and you can become so familiar. You can see your mind beginning to react, holding a certain opinion, getting kind of inflamed, and it's all ready to be reactive. But if you see that over and over again, and you know the suffering that results from it, you won't go there. Mindfulness will catch it way back at the beginning when you first get this flicker of seeing how the mind is posturing itself, how you're kind of holding something in the mind, or you're holding someone else in a certain way. But that knowledge, that deeply personal understanding of how the mind gets entangled can only come from observing and understanding that this is how it's happening over and over again. Sayadaw Utejaniya says, the mind is not yours. Meaning, stuff comes into your mind uninvited. But, he says, you're responsible for it. Once it comes into the mind, you got to deal with it. Mm-hmm. It may come uninvited, but you have to take care of it, or it'll cause you and others suffering. And in terms of what we experience, he goes on to say, don't try to avoid experience. There's all kinds of experience in life that we'd rather not have to deal with. But don't try to avoid it. You can't. There's so much unpleasantness. Well, there's pleasantness too, but there's so much unpleasantness, you can't avoid it all. But be alert for getting entangled in the defilements in relationship to what you experience. He says, don't try to avoid objects and experience, but try to avoid getting entangled in the defilements in relationship to them, the aversion to them, the desire for them, the fear of them. As long as you're aware of the defilements, you're doing well. Kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? Often we think, God, I struggle with the defilements all day. What a drag. Actually, if you are struggling with the defilements all day, that's good practice. So kind of we need to reframe our understanding of what we're doing here. You know, if we're just looking for good experiences, let me tell you, you're doing the wrong practice. They come, but not all the time. So knowing that, we should be prepared for, you know, the difficult, the challenges, the defilements, and be willing to work with them, knowing that that is good practice. So now that I've given you the introduction to the defilements, let's move on to the defilements. The familiar manifestations of the defilements in practice are the hindrances. So I want to just briefly touch on the five hindrances that you all know and love so well. But I want to just point to a couple of either facts about the hindrance or this particular one or how to work with it as a reminder for your time here this week. Sloth and torpor. Hello. First couple days. It's a frequent visitor to the mind. You might think it's a permanent resident today, but it really isn't. Now, sloth and torpor has two elements. One is the mind is just heavy, no energy, it's just sluggish, it can't move. That's torpor. But there's also sloth, which is laziness. That you can do something about. Torpor, well, you just have to endure it and kind of try to brighten the mind. Laziness, well, you can do something. In this book that we're translating and working on, the Mahasi Sayadaw book, The Manual of Insight, he lists, I have here, well, da, 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 da. There must be 100 different reflections that he offers for dealing with sloth and torpor. Hundreds. And he says the whole purpose of these reflections is to arouse what's called pamuja, which is spiritual joy. You know, kind of like joy in what you're doing. Even though it's a slog and even though the mind's sluggish and lazy, you know, if you can remind yourself of the nobility of what you're doing, it can bring a little brightness to the mind. But there's one reflection in there that is just a little counterintuitive for us Westerners. He says, in order to arouse spiritual joy in the mind, reflect on the suffering in hell. Right. Right, I'm sure that'll work. But he says that, he points to that because he says, you know, when you're in hell, you know, you're just tormented. The mind is just obsessed and the body's just so uncomfortable and there's nobody can help you and, you know, you don't have any opportunity to develop mindfulness and, you know, you're hot, you're cold, the mind is tight and constricted. It's, you know, it's just yucky. You know, it's like being angry. When you're angry, who can help you? It's your own mind. It's your mind that's doing it to you. So when you just think about what it's like to be caught in a hellish state of mind, and then remember, you're not there. You know, as bad as it could be, it's not happening now. You're just tired. You know, that should give you a little joy. It's like, wow, I'm glad I'm not caught in that hell. Well, that's what it's for. You know, when you reflect on how bad it could be and it's not as bad as it could be, that's joy. Anyway. One of the reflections that I like is a reflection that the Buddha taught. And he said, you know, now on the face of the earth, there's more than 6 billion people. 6 billion. The number of those people who have the discretionary time, the discretionary income, the knowledge, the interest, the karmic predisposition, the opportunity to hear the teachings, practice the teaching, and realize the teachings of freedom is minuscule. Somehow, we all got that opportunity. How did that happen? How is it that we can hear the Dharma and appreciate it and take an opportunity like this to come for 6 days? Not easy. Not easy to find the time. Not easy to find the resources. It's not easy to do. You know, I know. And yet, we still do it. Why? Think about that. It's not accidental. You know, many people in your life would have absolutely no interest in doing this. You got to be kidding. You know, why in the world would I want to do that? Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what is it in our mind? What is that common thread in our minds that allows us to do this or encourages us, inspires us to do this? Well, whatever it is, we can be thankful for it. We can call it karma, we can call it whatever. But if you've been practicing for a while, you know the benefit. You know, there's just some extraordinary, profound, maybe intangible benefit of doing this. Nobody said it was going to be easy. It never is. It's a challenge. It's always difficult. And yet, we keep coming back. You know, we could call it the taste of liberation. You can call it awareness. You can call it consciousness. You can call it integrity. You can call it whatever you want to call it. But there's something that we have, that we appreciate. And so many others do not. That's a helpful reflection. And I don't mean to kind of put us in an elite, kind of an exclusive elite. Hey, don't worry, we got plenty of suffering too. But that we are even interested in disentangling our hearts from suffering and the causes of suffering. Let's face it. There's some nobility in that. Ramana Maharshi says, no one succeeds without effort. Mind at peace is not your birthright. Those who succeed owe their liberation to perseverance. Right effort in practice is nothing more than just keep persevering. Just keep persevering. You know, be patient with what comes, but persevere with your practice. Again, Saito Tejaniya says, hey, it's perfectly natural to become sleepy. If you feel bad about sleepiness, it means you have aversion towards it and you will try to resist it. This is the wrong attitude. If you simply recognize and accept sleepiness, as long as you observe it with the right attitude, you're meditating. It's natural to be sleepy. Don't have to blame yourself. Don't have to struggle with it. Just accept, oh, this is the way it is now. Practice being mindfully aware of it. Second common visitor to the mind is doubt. Now, doubt is an interesting hindrance or defilement to mind because we often don't see it. You know, I did one retreat. I did my first retreat back in 75. A couple years later, I went on staff at the meditation center, and I hadn't practiced much. And I was having this really strong discussion one of my first days on the staff at the meditation center with another staff person who ended up being Rodney Smith up in Seattle. And I was telling him, I said, "Yeah, I have absolutely no doubt in this lifetime I am going to realize the Dharma." Of course, I had no idea what I was talking about. But nevertheless, I didn't let ignorance, you know, deter me from my aspiration. But I didn't have any doubt. And for years, I never had, 10 years, I never had any doubt. Never had a, I just loved to sit. I didn't do very good. I wasn't very mindful. I didn't really understand very much. I was suffering, but I didn't have any doubt. Until I got to Burma. And then my practice really took off, and I discovered doubt. And the doubt, for me, manifested in the form of self-pity. Oh, poor me. I can't do this because I'm too old. You know, I'm too stupid. I started too late in life. I'm too dull. I'm too impatient, you know, and other, you know, I did too many drugs, I didn't do enough drugs, whatever. You know, there's all kinds of, oh, poor me. Well, actually, every time I got caught in the, oh, poor me, and you know how strong that can be. Some of you have, oh, poor me. Oh, poor, I can't do this because, you know, whatever. Every time I got caught, I would stop practice, you know, and think, that's a given, that's a fact, can't deal with it. End of story. Until I started noticing it. And then I realized, oh, this is just a form of doubt that I can do with this practice. And then when I saw that, then I really got kind of like interested in all the stories of why I didn't think I could do it. And while I was noticing them, I was actually doing it. Never get caught in doubt like that anymore. Never. No matter what the story is kind of coming down and how oppressive and overwhelming and definitive it seems, never feels like, oh, poor me, I can't do this. Never. Why? I've seen it. I have seen it so many times. Hundreds of thousands of times I've been caught. And hundreds of thousands of times I've kept practicing in spite of it. That's how we overcome the defilements. We see them hundreds of thousands of times, and we keep practicing. After a while, it doesn't bother you anymore. You see it coming, it's there, it goes, you're still practicing. Doubt manifests in three ways. Irregular practice, wavering. You know, we get really enthusiastic and excited for an hour, and the rest of the day we kind of... or a week, or a year, or a retreat, or a teacher. And then we, you know, when your practice is irregular and wavering like that, there's some level of doubt in the mind. Unseen, unrecognized. But that's how it manifests. So if you have irregular practice, take a look at that. A second way that we experience doubt is procrastinating. We put off doing our practice, whatever we need to do in practice, till later. You know, we know we've got some issues to look at. We know we've got some, you know, we got some fear of sitting with pain. We got some fear of letting go of, you know, whatever we're hanging on to. We got some, you know, some defilements we just don't want to touch. Why? Well, we put it off. We put it off, we procrastinate, and we just kind of, you know, next retreat I'll deal with my knee pain. Next retreat I'll deal with, you know, sitting longer than 20 minutes. Next retreat, there's actually some kind of doubt in the mind that doesn't support making the continuity of effort or energy needed to deal with it. Third way of experiencing doubt, and this is really counterintuitive again, and it's frequent among us over intellectualized Westerners. We try to think it out. We use our logic, and we read all the books, and we read what every teacher says, and we really got it down so that we can figure it out. You can't figure it out. You cannot overcome doubt by figuring it out, by logic, by applying what you, remembering what you've read, and trying to have the internal debate with among everybody that you've read. That's not how to overcome doubt. Doubt can only be overcome through practicing with it, being mindfully aware of it. But we get caught in this reflection, reasoning, analysis, comparing, and this excessive learning I would call it, really just agitates the mind. Keeps the mind from actually settling down and getting through the doubt, working with the doubt. But, you know, our conditioning, our educational conditioning encourages a lot of speculation, reflection, problem solving, being analytical. And that's all helpful and it's good in its appropriate time and place. But it can't answer your doubt. It can't solve your doubt. It can't fix your doubt. Doubt, that kind of doubt of whether the practice works and whether you will do the practice can only be done by doing the practice. Doubt's tricky to see. It's hard to see. But nevertheless, it can be and must be eventually worked with. Aversion, another, frequent and common visitor to the mind, appears in three different grades, I call it. There's the striking out kind of aversion, the anger, the rage, the hatred. Well, maybe we're a little more refined and we don't feel so much anger, hatred, rage. But let me remind you of some... No, I won't. I mean, we all have buttons. Something can push our rage button, our anger button, our real, you know. Maybe we insulate ourselves pretty good. We've inoculated ourselves with all kinds of defense mechanisms so that we don't see it. Practice is to discover your buttons. If you've got some in there, you want to know. You want to find what causes you to be really rageful. Because if it's in the mind, we want to see it. We don't want to just hide from it. We actually want to expose it so we can deal with it and learn how to let go of it. Second form of aversion is the internalizing. When we internalize our aversion, we feel depressed, frustrated, disappointed, despairing. It's turning our aversion towards an inner sense of self. Common, really common. But it's a form of aversion. It's a way of, aversion is a way of kind of distancing ourselves from the situation, not staying in touch with what is unpleasant. It's an unpleasant situation, it's an unpleasant relationship, it's an unpleasant sensation in the body, in the mind, it's an unpleasant thought, having to do something or deal with something. And then there's the pushing away out of fear, out of irritation, out of cynicism, judgment, criticism. This is not the striking out of anger and hatred, it's not the internalizing, it's just kind of like keeping it at arm's distance, whatever it is, so that we don't actually have to feel how unpleasant something is and accept it. So we push it away. About aversion. It can be very gross. It can also be very subtle. And it's instructive to watch in your practice. When you get some momentum in your practice on a retreat, is to watch the subtlety of the mind trying to get away from experience. And you're sitting there and it's all going quite well and you just go, crack your neck. You just kind of get that neck. Why? Because there was some tension in the neck that we didn't like. And so aversion goes, ah, relief. Or, you know, after 40 minutes of a 45-minute sitting, you just kind of lean this way to take a little pressure off that knee. Why? Aversion. It's really instructive to watch what makes the body move. You sit down. Why does the body move? Is it move out of aversion or out of desire? One of them. Almost every intention to move the body is conditioned by aversion and desire. Watch. You'll see the subtlety of not liking what is going on in the body and the mind. Restlessness, another quality of mind that accompanies all the defilements. Mostly we recognize it as the wandering mind. The longer the wander, the stronger the restlessness. You know, in the beginning of practice, you know, we sit down and we notice that the mind only wanders two or three times in a sitting. Not bad. Except that each wander is 20 minutes each. That is bad restlessness. Later in practice, when we've really got some momentum and we're really doing good, we are just struggling to bring the mind back hundreds of times in a single sitting. Bringing the mind back from wandering mind. And we think, it's gotten worse. I've noticed my wandering mind 100 times in the sitting. Actually, that's better. It's better because the mind has not wandered so long. Yes, you're noticing the habit of, you know, trying to wander. But if you catch it, you know, instantly, you just see there, back, oh, catch it. That's actually good practice because the mind really isn't getting a chance to wander unimpeded. Mindfulness catches it. That's good practice. But so often in our deluded states of mind, we make the wandering mind the enemy of practice. Thoughts are the enemy. They're not. If we can get this, that thoughts are just thoughts, it is the natural activity of the mind. Don't struggle with it. If the mind wants to think, let it think. But try to be aware of thinking as you're thinking. Maybe it won't last long. Fine. Maybe it'll just come frequently. Fine. See if you can understand and really begin to see thoughts just arise naturally. You don't make them happen. Notice the thoughts that you have. Would you choose to have that thought? You don't choose to have that thought. It just comes from conditions beyond your control. All we have to do is see it. When we don't see it, it strengthens the habit of wandering mind. And we get identified with it, thinking it's my thought. Occasionally we can get a glimpse of just how impersonal the thoughts are in the mind. They just come. You know, if our thoughts were broadcast on a screen above our head, we would definitely not want to claim them as mine. Well, consider it. They're on display for everyone in the room to see. They're not yours. They just come. It's like the mind's an antenna. It just kind of picks up conditions and gives rise to thoughts. Attachment, certainly not the least of the defilements. In some ways, we could say it's all about attachment and practice is all about letting go. But we get attached, as you know, to people, things, experiences, our views and our opinions, and most importantly, our sense of ourselves. Whatever we do to hang on to things, people, experiences, memories, plans, future, who I am is attachment. All forms of attachment. If we can see that attachment is the cause of so much suffering. Rather than just trying to get rid of it, we would be encouraged to understand it. So I encourage you to really, when you notice attachment, desire, clinging, yearning, longing, identification in your mind, it isn't quite right to say, welcome it, but be willing to engage it with the motivation to understand, how is this happening? How is it that this idea, this thought, whatever, comes into the mind and I get seduced by it? How does that happen? What is it that, I mean, we've all had so many fantasies of how life could be better. And we've chased and fulfilled a lot of them. And we're still spinning out fantasies for the future. It's endless. When are we going to see through this illusion that desire is satisfying? Well, we're going to see through it when we make it a point to really understand how desire, attachment, identification works in the mind. But it's only by understanding it that we'll be able to see it coming and not get entangled in it. If you keep falling for greed and attachment, you'll never understand its nature. Take time to learn a little bit about greed and pay attention to its characteristics, Saito Utejaniya says. So this is the path, working with the defilements. From the grossest to the subtlest, from the beginning to the end, it's all about working with. And of course, the times when we're free temporarily, when we uproot permanently, these are significant milestones in our practice. They come. But it's through understanding. So if we can engage our practice and engage our defilements, seeking understanding rather than just trying to get rid of them, our efforts in practice will be well-founded. Only when we're able to recognize, understand, and let go of the defilements will wisdom grow. It's not you who removes the defilements. Wisdom does that job. When your understanding of the true nature of things grows, your values in life will change. When your values change, your priorities change as well. Through such understanding, you will naturally practice more, and this will help you to do well in life. So let's sit for a moment and let the words settle down. When your understanding of the true nature of things grows, your values in life will change. And when your values change, your priorities will change as well. And through such understanding, you will naturally want to practice more. And this will help you to do well in life.